Right, we're ready to continue our study of Ecclesiastes this morning, and we're just going to review a little bit the outline of the book because we're making a big transition today as far as where we're going in the book. So if you look here on our outline that we set up at the very beginning, it sort of starts out with the first half being chapters 1 through 6, verse 9, and we talked about the programmatic question being, what's the profit, or really the gain or the advantage that man gains by all of his work under the sun? And it was divvied up by, in 6 or 7, I think, 7 sections. And the final phrase at the end of every section was, everything is hevel and a striving after the wind. So that was repeated 7 times in the first half of the book, and then it was not repeated again after that at all. And so really where we're at is right in the middle of the book. We have just finished chapter 6, verse 9 last week, and now we're going to start in chapter 6, verse 10. And the last 3 verses of chapter 6 really are kind of like the turn. There's a transition from what we were talking about. It reviews a few things and then introduces the new questions that Qohelet asks about, that he's going to address in the second section. So that's kind of where we're at in the overall flow of the book. And his tone changes a little bit too. He changes from going on this expedition, this journey, to try and seek and to find what the profit of human endeavors is. And instead now he transitions to talk about how we should then live in the light of what he's discovered with this hevel. So it becomes a little bit more like Proverbs, not totally, but it transitions to be more like that than the first half. So if you're following along, then chapter 6, verse 10, we'll just read 10 through 12 first and get this transition, and then we'll look at chapter 7, verses 1 through 14. I guess I should make one other comment as well, that our new, previously we were looking for this phrase, everything is hevel and striving after the wind, and now with these new questions, the breaks that we're looking for are these statements about no one can find or no one having knowledge. Those are the breaks that we're going to be looking for in the second half. So, chapter 6, verse 10, we'll read the remainder of chapter 6. It says, whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? Okay, so we have here in verse 10, whatever has come to be has already been named. And what that sort of reminds us of, all of these things are kind of review of the first half. It brings up several strands, several threads of things that we've already discussed. So this sounds an awful lot like there's nothing new under the sun from chapter 1, verse 9, or chapter 3, verse 15, that which is already has been, right? That you just kind of have this idea of the reviewing the cycle, that there is generation after generation and a sovereign God over those things, but you can't get out of the cycle. Whatever has come to be already was. And then he says, and it is known what man is. And that reminds us of the reminders that we are human, that we are mortal, that our knowledge is limited, that we are finite. It's known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. That, again, kind of takes us back to chapter 3 and the reminder that God is the one who set the seasons in order that we may fear him. And so we are the ones that aren't able to dispute with him. The one stronger than us is God here. And we, in our finitude, do not have some of the answers that we wish that we had. So we're not able to dispute with God. Then verse 11, kind of more review, even from 2 weeks ago. The more words, the more vanity. And that kind of takes us back to chapter 5, verse 7, which said when words and dreams increase or when they grow many, there's vanity. Kind of how we approach the household of God and worship is to not come with an abundance of words, but to come with listening ears and with simple, genuine worship. And then he repeats the programmatic question, right? And what is the advantage to man, or what's the profit to man of all his work? So he's spending these two verses really just reviewing all of these threads and all of these things that have come through in the first half of the book. And then what he's going to do is he's going to transition and introduce the new questions that we're going to look at. He says, "For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow?" And then probably the primary question, "For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun?" Both of these are not, they're new in the sense that they're the theme of the second half of the book, but they've actually already been mentioned to us. They've been brought up. In chapter 2, verse 3, Solomon was beginning his expedition, and he said, "I searched with my heart till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life." So this is not new. This was in chapter 2, verse 3. And then the second question is also not new. We found it in chapter 3, verse 22, where he says, "Who can bring man to see what will be after him?" So he's already introduced these ideas, and now they're going to become the theme of what he's talking about. So for today particularly, one new theme that we're going to introduce is this idea of good. Again, it's not that we haven't seen it before. We have seen it. But it's the main theme for our conversation today, and becomes kind of a secondary theme throughout this second half of the book. So this idea of good is the Hebrew word tov. And it means good, first of all, but then if you put it in a comparison with something else, then it means better. And that probably sounds even more familiar to you. So we're going to go ahead and just read this next portion of the text. I want to point out all the times that this word is used, so you'll see that it becomes a theme for today. So chapter 7, verse 1 starts out, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death," kind of unspoken "better" here, "than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, 'Why were the former days better than these?' For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the days of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him." And this word joyful here is actually another usage of the same word. "In the days of prosperity, be good in your heart." So you can see really consistently this theme, this idea of good and better coming through, that it's used 11 times in this text alone out of 45 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. So about 25% of the usages are found here in this text. So here's kind of the transition that he's making. He says, what is the better or the good way to live in light of what we just looked at in the first half of the book? In light of all of this hevel around us and in light of our limitations and our finitude, how should we live? Now, he's already drawn some conclusions, right? He's told us, eat, drink, find enjoyment in your work. And he'll continue reminding us of those things. They're going to come up consistently again throughout the second half of the book. But he spends more time now fleshing that out. What does it actually look like to live with wisdom under the sun in this broken world? And he's already argued a little bit in the first half that wisdom is better, even though it doesn't solve all of your problems. And he's going to continue arguing that we should live with wisdom, but just explain a little bit more what it looks like for us. So our text today kind of seems to center especially on chapter 3, 1 through 15, as far as practical ways to live in light of the fact that God is sovereignly over the days, that some days are good, some days are bad. There's a day for mourning, a day for rejoicing, a day for death, a day for birth. And how should we respond in light of that? So here's the proposition for today. Wise people embrace the reality of hevel and live consistently even when hevel comes to them. Living this way protects you from folly and false expectations. It informs you of your inability to set hevel straight and prepares you for days of difficulty as well as days of delight. So it's a really long proposition, but we actually will step through every piece of that throughout the morning. So the first portion of that wise people embrace the reality of hevel. And that's chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. He starts out with a proverb. A good name is better than precious ointment. Okay, that makes sense to us. A good reputation, solid character is better than valuable things, right? It's better to be the solid guy with less stuff or with less nice things than the jerk with a yacht, right? You want to have good character. And sometimes that's only revealed really at the end of your life. Like ultimately, the day you die is the day you see if you were consistent in your character. Because sometimes even close to the end of people's lives, their character goes askew and they pursue other things. So this proverb that we understand, and the idea that this is only really revealed in death, I think is why he uses this proverb at the beginning as an introduction to this idea of some of these dark things that he kind of talks about. Because it makes sense to us that the good name is better, right? But after that, everything that he mentions is negative as better. He's not, after the good name is better, then he says the day of death is better, and that the house of mourning is better, and that sorrow is better, and that rebuke is better. He uses all of these negative things as better. And you're saying, wait, that's not what I was expecting after you just explained how life is difficult and life is hard, so at least take joy in the good things, right? He says, no, actually, some of these things that you view as really negative are very good for you to consider. So what's he saying? Let's kind of dive in a little bit deeper here. So he says, and then the day of death better than the day of birth. Again, very contrary to the way that we think. We think of, you know, that day in the hospital when a new baby is born as a much brighter day than the day at the funeral home where you bury a loved one. And then he says, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. So also, not only better to go to the to bury someone than to have someone born, but also better to, yes, go to this funeral, this house of mourning, than to a party or to a fun day or a feast day. Now, why does he say that? Why is it that the day of death is better than the day of birth? Why is it that the house of mourning is better than the house of feasting? And the key phrase to help us understand that is right here at the end of verse 2. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. What he's saying is that this reminds us that this is where all of us are going. This is the natural end of every human being, is that we will all have our own day of death. And the people around us, the people that love us, will all have go to the house of mourning on that day. That's where you are going. And what he says is, those who are living, and I think we could say the wise ones that are living, are the ones that actually let that sink in. They lay it to heart. They live in light of their death. So he's calling us to orient our life with the reality of death as its realistic end. He's calling you to be authentic. He's calling you to actually recognize reality and to not run away from it. It's better to do this. It's better to live this way than to play pretend. Than to play pretend and to live like you're going to live forever, which is a lie. In order to live a wise life, you have to embrace the fact of death. You will not live with wisdom if you live without considering the fact that you will end up returning to dust. Kind of continues this idea in verse 3 with this idea of, you know, negativity. Sorrow is better than laughter. Why? For by sadness of face, the heart is made glad. Sorrow teaches us several things, but yes, it teaches us to kind of treasure our days, right? But it also informs the manner that we should live. You know, often if you hear somebody tell a story of a time that they came really close to dying, came close to death, right? Particularly maybe like an accident where they were injured and it was a really close call. Then for at least a time after that, they live differently than they did before because they realize, wow, I could die at any time. And so they see for at least a glimpse what's most important in life. And they treasure those things rather than chasing whatever they were chasing before, because they realize if I had died, that would all be gone, and these relationships are really what I would have missed the most. So they reorient their life, but often that doesn't last very long, right? It only lasts for a little while, and then they kind of forget the lesson, and the reality and the excitement of their life distracts them from the reminder that they will die. So even on a practical level, I guess the verse 4 tells us the conclusion that the heart of the wise, really where we rest, where we remain in our minds, is the house of mourning. But the heart and the orientation of the fool's life is in the house of mirth. So, on a practical level, don't shield yourself, or parents, don't shield your children. Obviously, there's measures in which I think this is probably appropriate, but don't shield your children from death. It's the reality of life. Take them to the funeral. Let them see the sobriety of what's happening, and let them consider, I will die one day too. So how should I live my life? So sorrow and death help us to orient the way that we should live. And then verse 5, he gives another example of some of the difficult things that wise people should use to orient their life. We embrace the reality of Hevel. Then he says in verse 5, it's better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. One is better than the other. Proverbs 12, verse 1 says this beautifully. It says, whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but those who hate to be rebuked are stupid, right? He's just saying, if you're not willing to listen to someone give you wise correction, loving constructive criticism, Right? If you are not willing to listen to that, or if you would prefer to listen to empty praise about you, then you're living as a fool. He's saying wise people take the more sober approach. Wise people say, no, tell me, I want to listen, I want to grow, I want to be changed, rather than hear empty songs praising me for whatever they want to say. This idea of foolishness kind of has a very temporary feel to it. You know, this party, this house of mirth, these just great songs of accolade and praising you. And then the words we're about to talk about, the laughter of fools, all of it just seems like it comes and it goes really quick. But what should stick is the more sober things. What should stick is the sorrow. What should stick is the rebuke of wise people, the criticism of people who love you and care for you and speak wisdom into your life. Now, why is that? I guess what we just explained. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. The character of fools' laughter and their praise and their good time is just like if you were to try and build a fire or boil water under a sagebrush. Like if you just put this dry, crackling sagebrush underneath and you lit the fire, it would light really quick and it would burn really fast, but it would produce very little heat. It would not be sustainable. It would just be here and gone, like the crackling of thorns underneath a pot. Maybe it sounds cool, it looks cool for a short time, but ultimately it doesn't actually produce anything positive. It doesn't produce anything enduring. So it's better to hear rebuke. It's better to go to the house of mourning. Sorrow is better. I guess that one phrase we didn't explain was here, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. We've talked about the idea, but it seems like what he's saying here is that sobriety actually causes you to make significant changes in the way that you live. And in so doing, you live a better life. Your heart is glad. Your life is better because you've allowed sorrow and difficult things, even hevel, to change you and to orient the way that you live. Okay, so that's the first idea, is that wise people embrace the reality of hevel. But now he transitions in verse 7 and following to say wise people live consistently, even in the face of hevel. Even when hevel affects them, they're going to live consistently with what wisdom has taught them. So here in verse 7, he starts out, surely oppression or extortion is another possible translation here. And I think it's probably favorable. Surely oppression or extortion drives the wise into madness. And a bribe, that's one of the reasons it seems like extortion is probably what he's talking about, this financial gain, corrupt financial gain. A bribe corrupts the heart. Wise people have to be on guard, because even if you live knowing that hevel is going to happen, that still doesn't mean that you've oriented your life in such a way that when hevel happens to you, you're going to live consistently. So let's just say the wise person who knows hevel happens is in a difficult financial situation, or he is seeking to grow his personal empire, right? He wants to grow and build his heap of stuff. And so he does so, yes, in light of hevel, but he's going to still continue doing so with extortion or bribery, and it corrupts the way that he's chosen to live. It corrupts the wisdom with which he was seeking to live his life. He's been turned away from the wise lifestyle. I think it's probably better, even better illustrated in the following verses, 8 and following, 8 and 9 especially. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. And we'll continue in a moment with the rest. But 7 through 10, What he's saying here in verses 8 and 9 is that patience is better. So living in the face of hevel is one thing, but doing so with patient endurance is another. I'm not sure if I'm clearly explaining the distinction between the two, or the step that he's making here, is that you personally now have to take what you know in your wisdom and live it out consistently. So when hevel hits you, you still have to be patient. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. So we have kind of two ideas here. Better is the end of the thing than its beginning. We have a phrase in English that kind of wraps this up, right? All's well that ends well. We acknowledge that just because something starts out good doesn't mean it's going to end good. This kind of echoes back, I think, even to the good reputation of the man, the good name of the man. Just because one starts well in life doesn't mean you finish well. I think all of us have experienced that on some level, that we all have great ideas and we initiate, right? We begin the race, but then there are not very many of the people that begin well that also end well. Many people face enough hevel that they lose consistency in the way that they live. They turn away from wisdom because they think that hevel is anti-wisdom, but it's actually not. Wisdom helps you live in the face of this crooked world. So we need to be consistent in the way that we live. But then this idea of patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit, that's a great way to say it. A lot of people even say, like, endurance is better than arrogance, which is exactly the idea. But there's a really cool word picture that's actually going on in Hebrew here. Because the way that he says it is, he says, better is the long spirit than the tall spirit, is how he explains it. So it's just kind of this cool picture that endurance and patience and waiting is better than this arrogance and this height of a view of yourself, a high view of yourself. So have a long spirit, not a tall spirit. And then he kind of explains what happens with the tall spirit in verse 9. Because the tall spirit is quick in their spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. So when hevel strikes, how are you going to respond? The wise patiently endure. The foolish angrily retort. When you respond in frustration when something doesn't go your way, which, let's face it, all of us have probably done even this last week, we're publicly demonstrating that we were living with false expectations. We were living foolishly, not allowing wisdom to instruct the way that life under the sun works. It's only when we have that wisdom in hand that we're able to respond with temperance and self-control, understanding the brokenness of life in a fallen world. So the fool's surprised at hevel, is what he's trying to say. Right? And he responds like, how did this happen? Why would this go this way? But the wise person says, no, that makes sense. The world's broken. The world's full of hevel. I've seen that. I understand that. And because I understand that it's coming, it's better to know that it's coming and to be able to respond properly. So wise people live consistently. No extortion, no bribes, patience. And then in verse 10, contentment. Say not, why were the former days better than these? Because it's not from wisdom that you ask this. Complaining reveals not only a lack of contentment and self-control, but it also reveals a lack of wisdom. It's not from wisdom that we complain. It's not from wisdom that we're discontent. Because wisdom enables us to know, yes, that life isn't fair. Demanding equality in life or equality of opportunity is absurd. But it's even beyond that. It enables you to live life under the sun, acknowledging that it's broken because someone greater than you broke it and you can't fix it. But he's in control and he allows hevel for a reason. So only a man filled with folly, and this flies in the face of how we react in a lot of circumstances, but when we react that today, or we demand that today be as sunny as yesterday, or that tomorrow be just as good as last year, or that 2020 be just as good as 2019, right? We demonstrate our folly. We demonstrate that we're not living with wisdom. I love the last verse of the song, The Perfect Wisdom of Our God. And it says, each strand of sorrow has a place within this tapestry of grace. So through the trials, I choose to say your perfect will in your perfect way. And that really, I mean, it's a New Testament understanding, but it's an understanding of the sovereignty of God in Hevel is what it is. So wise people embrace the reality of Hevel, and then they live consistently even when Hevel comes to them. But then there's this third idea, that wise people actually have an advantage in life under the sun. And that's verses 11 through 14. Wise people have an advantage, and there's a few of them. Wisdom is good, he says, with an inheritance. Or wisdom is better, right? There's value in wisdom with an inheritance. An advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. And the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Okay, so we have a key word here in verse 12, because we finally see that there is an advantage to something under the sun. That's the entire question in the first half of the book, is what's the yitron? What's the gain? What do I get that puts me ahead? And he says, you don't in your work, but wisdom does have an advantage. Not that you escape Hevel, but wisdom gives you an advantage that you live well. And we'll talk about that in a second. So verse 11, what's he saying here? Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. Okay, so if you get an inheritance, that's great, right? You get a haul, and you have money, and you have stuff that you can use, and that's awesome. That's excellent. That's a gift. That's a good thing. But it's better if what accompanies that inheritance is the inheritance of wisdom as well, right? Better to receive this, let's just say your father dies and he leaves you an inheritance, right? It's better to receive that as well as all of the wise instruction and the proverbs that your father has taught you than it is to just get the money by itself. Wisdom helps us to not make an inheritance useless. And it says it's really only good for those who see the sun, right? This is only good for people who are still alive. Like, even we've talked a lot about the Hevel of losing all of your stuff while you're still alive, right? And he's saying it's better, it's beautiful, it's great if you're able to have this while you still have breath, while you still have life, if you're able to have the wisdom along with the inheritance, and it's an advantage to those who are under the sun. Why? Because the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. Okay, that's a little bit interesting. Some people would strongly agree with that. Other people might have a little bit of a hesitation, like, well, that sounds kind of funny. Well, money protects you? Well, absolutely. Money is incredible. Money's great, right? Money helps you not to worry about a lot of other things that you would worry about naturally. You're like, those who have a lot of money never wonder where their next meal's coming from. Those who have money never wonder about if they're going to be able to make the rent next month. Right? Those who have a lot of money can actually even hire physical protection if they wanted to. Like, there's a lot of great things about having more money. It's a safer. It's like protection. In fact, this word protection, that translation is a little bit of an interpretation. The word is shade or shadow. Actually, I think it's shadow. The shadow of wisdom, which there would say is like shade or like protection. So the idea is the shadow of wisdom, meaning like if it's blocking you from the sun, right? It's kind of protecting you, is the imagery that is probably being used. So the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. And he says, absolutely, money protects you from a lot. And so does wisdom. They're alike in that way. They make life better. They make life easier. But there's one way in which knowledge or wisdom is actually better than money. If you were to only receive one of the two, as tempting as it would be to go for the money, it would be better to go for the wisdom. Why? Because wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Or wisdom really gives life. It instructs life. It preserves you. It protects you in ways that money cannot. Money by itself could be used really wisely or used really poorly. Money could get you into a lot of trouble as well as be a lot of value for you. But wisdom, on the contrary, actually instructs the way that you live and helps you to live well. It gives you life. Money is kind of neutral in that way, or it could or it couldn't, but wisdom does. So that's one advantage, is that wisdom protects you from folly. It protects you from false expectations. And then in verse 13, wisdom informs you, again, this is not a new thing, this is a review thing. Wisdom informs you of your inability to set Hevel straight, which is opposite from our expectations. Let's read this. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Because we have this again, the divine enters here and we're reminded, I'm not the divine one. I'm finite. Consider what God has done. How could I undo what he's decided to do? Now, this is different than our expectations. Again, and I know I've probably said this already too many times, but this is what he's talking about. So I think repetition's good. This has to do with what we expect wisdom to do. Because we often expect wisdom to be able to unravel the tangled mess in front of us. Or we expect, perhaps more appropriate to the illustration here, we expect wisdom to set the bones straight and to undo Hevel, to make it right again. And if we have that expectation of wisdom, then we will be severely disappointed every time. But that's not actually what wisdom does. So wisdom informs us, actually, of our inability. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? And then in verse 14, there's another thing that wisdom does. Wisdom prepares you for days of difficulty as well as days of delight. It says, in the days of prosperity, be joyful. And in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. So here's kind of his conclusion, or is the conclusion to the introduction of the second half of the book. You remember back at the very beginning of 7:1, there was the day of death as well as the day of birth. So it seems like there's maybe a little bit of an inclusio here, bookends, right, to this section. Days of prosperity and the days of adversity. So on the good days, rejoice, enjoy them. He's already instructed us to do that, right? Eat, drink, and enjoy your work. So on those days, yeah, have at it. Be grateful that that's a good gift from God. But in the day of adversity, when the day is not going as you have planned or as you would like, or when there's Hevel that enters your world, consider, remember, meditate on this truth. God made both of them. God made the good day. God made the day of adversity. Why? Why would he do that? This, again, is echoes of chapter 3, versus the poem about time and then the sovereignty of God entering so that we would fear before him, right? He echoes that again, and he says, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Now, this idea of after him, I should have said this at the beginning, because that was part of the main question, is what happens after us. This isn't actually talking, most likely, about eternity. This is talking about life under the sun. In fact, if you go back to the beginning here, his question is, for who can tell man what will be after him, where? under the sun. So under the sun is still our sphere of reference. And he says, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You can't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But tomorrow was made by God to remind you of your finiteness. And so what does wisdom do here? Wisdom informs us. Wisdom tells us the truth about what life is like. Yeah, ignorance is bliss. Sometimes it would be better not to consider these things. But bliss isn't reality. That's the point. Wisdom helps you prepare for the hard realities of life under the sun. It will not be easy. You will suffer loss. You might even lose everything. You will see oppression. You may even be oppressed personally. You will see righteous men fall, and you'll see wicked men exalted. You'll see judges take bribes and criminals get away with evil. You'll see people lose the battle of life to a virus. But it's better if you know that that is the truth about reality, and you know the one who made it that way and who is powerful enough to make this crooked world straight again. That's the better life. Much better than the foolish life where we say, you know what? I'm just going to enter the house of mirth. I'm just going to party. I'm just going to sing praise to my friends. I'm just going to babble off useless words. And I'm going to respond in anger to the hevel because it doesn't make sense to me. And I'm going to be discontent and I'm going to be frustrated during the bad days. And if I get a great inheritance, who cares if I use it with wisdom or not? It's the way life is. And a lot of people respond that way. But wisdom teaches us the better way to live. Wisdom teaches us, I'll just say the proposition one more time and we'll be done. Wise people embrace the reality of hevel and live consistently even when the hevel comes to them. Living in this way protects us from folly and false expectations. It informs us of our inability to avoid or set hevel straight, and it prepares us for difficult days as well as days of delight.